The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice is a knowledge exchange initiative in the far northern part of Albiala, now commonly referred to as Canada, that's led by the London, Ontario Intercommunity Health Centre in partnership with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, the Ontario Aboriginal HIV/AIDS Strategy, and the Alliance for Healthier Communities. Its goal is to scale up safer supply programs across Canada. On July 24th, the National Safer Supply Community of Practice launched a community report entitled A Prescription for Safety, a study of safer opioid supply programs in Ontario. The report focuses on four Ontario safer opioid supply programs and presents key findings from interviews with clients, providers, and pharmacists. Let's hear from a few of the speakers. Dr. Adrian Gutta is an associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Windsor.
If you're wondering about the initial title of the project, Emergency Safer Supply Programs, the discussion that day was very much framed around safer supply being an emergency intervention to address a public health emergency. And we were worried that the grant reviewers might question the sustainability of this, right? So what if it gets shut down tomorrow and we don't have anything to evaluate? Of course, that hasn't happened, despite attempts. And safer supply has only grown since then. We were subsequently invited to submit a full proposal in October, and we received a notice that we'd been funded at the end of February of 2020. So I remember being very excited and wanting to get started. The universe had some other plans. So I'm not going to go into too much detail here, except to say that 2020 and 2021 didn't work out as many of us had expected or hoped. And in terms of the project, we had a lot of challenges and some false starts kind of along the way, getting the research going because of pandemic-related public health orders. So stay-at-home orders, which came and went, and staged reopenings. I recall seeing some reporting at one point that said Ontario had the longest continuous lockdown in the world. So in addition to the public health orders, we also had to contend with research activities being suspended at most universities, and then needing to navigate not only ethics review, but also new safety committees, which many universities had implemented. We were able to do some of the interviews over the phone, but we had to wait until September of 2021 for in-person interviews to resume. And in-person interviews are, of course, very important for reaching the many community members who don't have access to phones or internet. Our partner sites were Intercommunity Health Centre, London, Parkdale Queen West Community Health Centre, both sites, South Riverdale Community Health Centre, and Street Health. They all offer tablet hydromorphone prescribing with wraparound primary care and system navigation. Their names are shared with permission, and they were instrumental in supporting this work. Although we were seriously delayed, this coincided with SUAP funding becoming available in 2020, and many of the programs actually grew during this period. By the time we started data collection, many of the programs had expanded their staffing levels and the number of clients they were serving. So this is just a bit of a snapshot in time from 2021. So Parkdale had about 92 clients, 6 prescribers, and 8 allied health professionals, South Riverdale 46, 1 prescriber and 2 allied health, Street Health 31, 1 prescriber, 2 allied health, and London was the largest program with 247 clients at the time, and 2 prescribers and 10 allied health professionals. Just a bit about methods and I'll keep it very high level. We conducted semi-structured interviews with 27 safer supply prescribers, so physicians and nurse practitioners, allied health, sort of defined broadly to include everyone in the continuum of care within these programs. And it was very clear that these were very well integrated teams, and also some pharmacists who were willing to talk with us. And most importantly, 52 clients who shared their experiences in these programs. The interviews were conducted in person via Zoom and telephone and were audio recorded and transcribed.
That was Dr. Adrian Guta, an associate professor in the School of Social Work at the University of Windsor. Rose Schmidt is a PhD candidate in social and behavioral health at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto.
Most of the clients had some previous engagement with a substance use service. 87% had used methadone, been on a methadone program in the past, and 50% had been to some sort of live-in or inpatient treatment program. Most were not currently using a use of opioid agonist treatment, so 70% were not currently using one, and a fair number of people had reported that they used an opioid other than their safer supply in the last month. So as Adrian said, we interviewed 27 service providers. That's 21 people in the programs, as well as six pharmacists. Over half of the service providers identified as women, and they had a fair amount of experience. Around 60% had between 6 and 10 years of experience working with people who use drugs. So when we did thematic analysis, we looked at sort of what were the key things that were coming out of what people told us. So for the report, we focused on five major themes that we kept seeing coming up in interviews. The first one was that safer supply programs saved lives. So before joining the program, most clients had experienced multiple and frequent overdoses. However, since starting the program, many clients reported that they'd either not overdosed or that they were overdosing significantly less frequently. We heard over and over again people tell us that the program saved their lives. Having a steady access to a safe supply of opioids also helped participants manage their withdrawal symptoms. Many clients also told us that they were changing the way that they used opioids. So, for example, some people reported that they switched from injecting to either only or mostly swallowing their prescription instead. Some clients also reported that they reduced the frequency or the quantity of unregulated drugs that they were using. And some people reported that they had stopped using drugs other than their safer supply altogether, even though that was not a goal of the program. So we have a few quotations sprinkled throughout. I don't think I'd still be here. I think I'd be dead by now. It saved my life and it's going to save my life. I don't know where I'd be today without this program. That's from one of the clients of the programs. So the second major theme we found was that these programs were really adaptable and they were very flexible. As Adrian mentioned, all of the programs that were included in the study provided wraparound primary care in addition to the safer supply prescription. There were differences in how these programs operated. You saw that some of them had much larger teams and they had services in-house, whereas others had quite small teams of just three people. And they wound up relying on organizations outside of their other organizations to provide some other services to their clients. However, despite that, across all the programs, some key approaches were used, and key approaches included being client-centered, being trauma-informed, and being harm reduction-oriented. The programs were very flexible, and the clients were drivers of their own care plans. And this allowed the programs to account for the complex needs of many of the people in the programs. Across the programs, service providers told us that, yes, prescribing opioids is important and it reduces overdoses, but they also told us that the relationships that they were building with clients helped clients to feel safe enough to trust healthcare and social supports again. And clients similarly told us that the caring service providers and the relationships that were built on mutual respect were really key to the success of the program. So this is from an allied health provider. We reintroduce healthcare. We do full primary care, full social support. We really try to integrate ourselves into every part of our patients' lives and help with anything and everything we can. based on their own goals and what they want. So related to that was that the SOS programs, the Safer Supply programs, improved health as well as the access to healthcare. So we know that many people who use drugs have had negative experiences with healthcare and with substance use treatment services in the past. And these negative experiences can really be heightened for women and gender diverse people, as well as Indigenous people, people with disabilities, and members of the African, Caribbean, and Black community. By meeting the needs of the clients and honoring and the value of their lives and valuing their dignity and demonstrating care for their well-being using those principles I mentioned, the client-centered care, the trauma-informed practice, harm reduction, the Safer Supply programs really helped build trust and to re-engage people with the healthcare system. As a result, many clients told us that they were healthier now. They noted specific improvements in their physical health, like having better pain management, being better able to stick to medications for conditions like diabetes or HIV, particularly when these medications were dispensed at the pharmacy at the same time as their Safe Supply. They reported having reduced infections and injection-related complications like endocarditis. A number of people told us that they had started addressing or completing long outstanding diagnostics or screening like mammograms, as well as having things like better sleep and improved mobility, more energy. Clients also reported a positive impact on their mental health, including a reduced social isolation, less stress, less fear and worry, and an improved mood. The programs also help clients access other services. So through system navigation, help them connect with healthcare, social supports, and harm reduction services like HIV testing, as well as dental care, safe consumption sites, those sorts of things. So this is from a client: I got my eyes done, my dental's being done, I have problems from head to toe, yet they work with me. So related, SOS program clients and staff told us that clients had an improved quality of life by participating in these programs. They had increased stability and they'd improved social determinants of health. Most clients described that before they had participated in the Safer Supply program, they were stuck in a cycle of doing survival activities that are criminalized, like sex work and stealing, to get money, and then buying drugs, and then using drugs, and then going back to make money. But the Safer Supply program helped break this cycle. The cycle had made it hard to work towards other goals and to work to take part in other life activities. Most clients also said that they now had improved personal finances because they no longer were spending all their money on unregulated drugs. Clients described that the program led to increased stability, like housing and food security, although many noted how difficult it was to find affordable and appropriate housing in both Toronto and London. Some clients told us that they had improved relationships with their friends and family. Many told us that they no longer had to do things for money that they didn't want to do, and that they had money for other things, like they had money for food and going out, computers, cell phones, making plans. Some clients told us that because of the Safe Supply, they were able to return to work or to start work or to start volunteering. And for many clients, the program had really changed how they viewed themselves and had improved their outlook on life. So, for example, being able to participate actively in their life made them feel more responsible. This is from a client: I've seen how my life drastically changed. I have a job. I have an apartment. I have bills I pay for. I have a car. I have real life responsibilities that I never had before. And all this is because of the program. And finally, we heard from service providers that delivering the SOS programs was challenging, but it was very rewarding. So the programs faced many challenges. As we've said, that they were very small programs and they were trying to address a very big and very complex problem. And there's a lot of people who are in need of support. The small number of staff did make it difficult to do things like handle absences and sick leaves. And while staff compensated for these challenges, this could lead to burnout. We know that the pandemic increased opioid-related harms and death, and there was a high demand for these programs at the time, as there continues to be now. So as a reminder, the data was collected in 2021. And we heard that the public health strategies that were put in place to reduce the transmission of COVID-19 had been causing some problems for the programs, such as having to limit the number of people in waiting rooms, which resulted in and long wait times and limited capacity to enroll new clients. Programs implemented strategies to try and manage the increased demand by doing things like focusing on the highest need clients first, making changes to wait lists, like focusing on same-day admissions. But by focusing on the highest need clients, it wound up taking longer to stabilize clients' doses, as well as address many of their health needs. And as a result, this made that the programs took longer to have the capacity to enroll new clients. This is important because while they were waiting to be enrolled in a program, there is the potential that someone might overdose. And they also might have higher needs when they are accepted into the program. Despite these challenges, the staff persisted. They were able to stabilize clients on safer supply. And staff described the work as very rewarding. They observed how the programs were really helping people who use drugs, and that they were really proud of their role in these changes.
That was Rose Schmidt, a PhD candidate in social and behavioral health at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto, speaking July 24th at an event sponsored by the National Safer Supply Community of Practice to launch a new community report entitled A Prescription for Safety, a study of safer opioid supply programs in Ontario. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Dr. Carol Strike is a professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto.
We asked all of the participants, people who were on the programs and people who were delivering the programs, what they would recommend to make the programs better. And these are some of the things that they told us. They talked a lot about providing more options for safer supply. So they talked about having a wider range of medications that they could prescribe or receive. So people talked to us about how they wanted injectable hydromorphone. People also talked to us about how they actually preferred heroin and they'd like to be able to access that through the program. Some people wanted access to fentanyl, prescribed fentanyl, because they liked it and or they had a tolerance that was very high and they found they couldn't quite meet their tolerance with the hydromorphone they were getting. And some wanted access to stimulants that not through the safe, not through the street supply, which was contaminated. And they believed that it was important in terms of their health to have access to a safe supply of stimulants and the like. And if you go to the next slide, Adrian, someone talks about, you know, why they wanted heroin. So someone told us, you know, their drug of choice would be heroin. If I could get heroin, I'd be happy. I know it's got lots of legs and I enjoy the high. And they felt that, you know, the dilaudid was different and they would have preferred having heroin. People also talked to us about getting safe supply through different ways. People enjoyed their time in the program, and many wanted to stay, but some also talked about wanting other ways to get safe supply. So those included, you know, perhaps a more nuanced discussion of legalization of drugs and the availability of compassion clubs, because there was a concern from prescribers and people on the program that they knew people who couldn't get in because of the limitations of the program. And some people, even if they could get in, didn't want in because they didn't want to be part of a medicalized model because of prior experience in medicalized environments or for other reasons. And people talked about, you know, that by providing a wider range of options, it would increase the accessibility of a safer supply through these different models. And people also pointed out to us that that safer supply programs may still have some barriers for people who are pregnant, people who are parenting, and that specific programming was necessary for these groups in particular. As this one physician said, I would personally love it if we had a grassroots version of safe supply where people who use drugs were actually able to have access to legalized tested substances, not just like decriminalization, but actually talking about legalization in a nuanced way. And, you know, pretty much every day in the news, there's a story about the housing affordability crisis across Ontario. And this was an issue and still is an issue from what I understand for the programs about housing, that housing is really important for people in terms of improving their overall well-being. And that even though people want to do really well in these programs, sometimes lacking a secure and safe housing impeded their ability to get as much as they possibly could out of the programs. And they really wanted more options. And they found that there were limited options in the cities that where we did our study. And that's not, you know, specific to these cities at all in Canada. Providers also talked about how the housing shortage and the insecurity in housing hampered their connection to the program and also their ability to interact with their clients, because sometimes they were hard to find. You know, if you think about people being moved out of a shelter to another side of the city, losing their cell phone or whatever, and it's hard to find them. And it's also hard for people to come to the programs, and now they have to pay for transit and the like, and the housing was really becoming an impediment for some people to do better than they already were doing in the programs. So as this quote says, you know, we have housing finders. So it wasn't that, you know, they couldn't have people to help people find clients, but as they said, but we have no housing, and the housing we have is wildly unaffordable. A lot of people talked about the necessity of expanding the size and the reach of the programs. So a lot of these programs, you know, had a small staff complement, they had limited budgets. They felt that they could do more, but they couldn't in terms of their current model. And also, as Rose was saying earlier, some of them took, because of their limitations, they took the very most at-need people, which meant that it was harder for them to bring in more people because it took a longer time to help people stabilize and move forward in the program. So participants told us a lot about the need for more family doctors and also nurse practitioners who are willing to prescribe safe supply. This would help increase the capacity of the teams. It would also provide an opportunity for some of them to take a leave, to go on vacation, because they didn't have coverage for those types of things. They also wanted more opportunities to provide enhanced client support, like particularly mental health and including trauma-informed counseling. And they wanted to increase their peer programming with more connections and more navigation, but they faced some limitations in terms of their budgets. And some of them just plain lacked space, and they wanted more opportunities to, you know, have space where they were, and also more spaces in particular across their geographic location where they were, so they could provide coverage to a wider range of a greater number of clients. So as this physician said, we need more capacity, more prescribers, because Safe Supply is almost like a boutique program. A lot of people talked to us about sustainability. There was a lot of concern about the sustainability of the programs in terms of their size and their ability to provide the range of care that they wanted for their clients. They also recognized that expanding and also providing some security for this program was going to require a lot of support at the in terms of funding and political and community support, that you know, they needed more funding and they needed support for getting more funding. And that to do that, there need to be a lot of advocacy and education about the impact of these programs and the need for the programs moving forward. As one client said, my only issue with this program is that it's not far reaching enough. I feel so badly when I see that people aren't on the program that want to get in. That's my only concern. And this is we heard this repeatedly from all different kinds of participants.
That was Dr. Carol Strike, a professor at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto, speaking July 24th at an event sponsored by the National Safer Supply Community of Practice to launch a new community report entitled A Prescription for Safety, a Study of Safer Opioid Supply Programs in Ontario. Nat Kaminsky is the president of the Ontario Network of People Who Use Drugs and a researcher at the Dalhousie School of Public Health at the University of Toronto.
What I really enjoyed about the project was the engagement with people who use drugs throughout this. So we had a community advisory board, which was made up of people who were either waiting for the program, on the program, people on the program are waiting to be on the program. We met five times over the project, provided input on, they provided input on research, the data collection tools that we were using, and throughout like our process and the pivots that we are making. Folks came from the various programs that were involved in Toronto and London, and they provided input on the draft reports that we had. So participants, we interviewed 52 clients across the four programs. London, 40% of the interviews are done, Parkdale Queen West, 30%, South Riverdale, 20, and Street Health, 10. 56% of folks identified as men and 44% identified as women. The average age was 47, but they ranged from 29 to 62. And the ethnicity was broken down to 79% white, 17% Indigenous, 2% ACB, and 2% Latino. Of the folks interviewed, 7 folks were HIV positive, all were currently on medication, and all had undetectable viral loads, and 77% of the clients had never received a hepatitis C positive diagnosis. So as I said in the beginning, part of what I love about working at U of T is that I've been able to see how community is involved throughout research, whether it's part of advisory boards or actually being on the research team, helping develop the plan. And so additionally, you know, as on the Ontario Network of People Who Use Drugs, and from being a part of CPID membership, people who use drugs need to be involved at all levels in programming and delivering programming to our community, helping to shape it into something that we want and need. So much like the recommendations that we heard in the study, people who use drugs across Canada are calling for people with power and privilege to join us in our fight for decrim. We are often putting our own community care models out, trying to ensure that we're reaching folks who need support. And so there's different models from Ontario all the way to BC of people who use drugs, starting compassion clubs and getting involved in the advocacy. And so that would just be the additional recommendations that I would have if you're doing this work, for you to participate in some of the work that we as people who use drugs across the country are doing and fighting for.
That was Nat Kaminsky, president of the Ontario Network of People Who Use Drugs and a researcher at the Dalhousie School of Public Health, University of Toronto, speaking July 24th at an event sponsored by the National Safer Supply Community of Practice to launch a new community report entitled A Prescription for Safety, a Study of Safer Opioid Supply Programs in Ontario. That report and many, many more resources are available at the National Safer Supply Community of Practice's website, which is nss-aps.ca. That's nss-aps.ca. And finally, a quick reminder that August 31st is International Overdose Awareness Day. Overdose Awareness Day is an annual event. It's the world's largest annual campaign to end overdose, to remember without stigma those who have died from overdose, and to acknowledge the grief of the family and friends left behind. The theme for International Overdose Awareness Day 2023 is Recognizing Those People Who Go Unseen, which is about acknowledging people in our communities who are affected by overdose but might go unseen in the crisis. You can find information about International Overdose Awareness Day at the website overdoseday.com. That's overdoseday.com. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio board service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.